Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's Supreme Court arguments over striking down Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that requires nine states with a history of discrimination to seek prior approval from the Justice Department to change their election laws. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Centre, who frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation, joins us. We'll discuss early indications that Scalia and other conservatives on the court are itching to turn back the clock. Then we will speak with a veteran crime reporter with the Boston Globe, Shelley Murphy, the author of the new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. We'll discuss little-known aspects of the case, such as Bulger's participation in the CIA's MK-Ultra LSD experiments, the extent of corruption and criminal complicity in the FBI that enabled C4 explosives to be shipped to the IRA, and the most wanted fugitive's final capture in Santa Monica, based on a tip from a friend of mine. Then finally, we'll go to London and get a perspective on how America's impending self-inflicted economic wound is seen from abroad and how the Europeans are reacting to the re-emergence of Berlusconi and the political paralysis he brings to the Eurozone's third largest economy that threatens to unravel modest gains made so far in stabilizing the euro. Economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones joins us to discuss the devastating effects austerity have had on Europe, yet in spite of the warnings, the world's largest economy is poised to drink the same poison. Joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
And your organization, the Constitutional Accountability Center, filed an amicus brief in this case, Shelby versus Holder, in defense of Section 5. So you clearly have a dog in this fight, if you will.
Yes.
I'm sorry for the Bill Clinton quote there. It doesn't look good, does it? I mean, my impressions, particularly some of the more hostile questioning that came from Justice Scalia, where he said that he derided the legislation as a perpetuation of racial entitlement.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly left the courthouse feeling more optimistic than I did this morning. But, you know, those of us who support the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and I should mention that while I work for a left-leaning organization, support for the Voting Rights Act in this case has been across the ideological spectrum. You have the Attorney General for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush leading a brief in support of the act. So, you know, it's a reflection of the fact that, as we'll talk about in a moment, there is widespread support for the Voting Rights Act, and in fact, that's why Congress overwhelmingly, bipartisanly, I mean, can we even imagine that, you know, happening today, reauthorized this preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. But you're right, Justice Scalia went on a rather, honestly, a bizarre and frankly offensive rant about how the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, one of the most iconic civil rights laws ever passed by Congress, was, in his words, a perpetuation of racial entitlement. And, you know, I think that the right to vote free from discrimination is an American entitlement, something that we all should be able to expect. And so I thought that that just was really, frankly, shocking.
So did anybody point out to Justice Scalia, not that he had the opportunity to get in arguments with the justices, but just the fact that in the last election, the Section 5 was used I think in both in the Texas case and in a South Carolina case by the Justice Department to strike down changes to election laws that would have discriminated against students, women, and Latinos largely.
Yeah, you know, I was actually surprised that what happened in the 2012 election didn't come up during argument today. Certainly what came up was the record that Congress amassed in 2006 when it reauthorized the act, more than 15,000 pages of incidents of state-sponsored racial discrimination in the areas covered by the preclearance provision. But you're absolutely right that the 2012 election proved that the Voting Rights Act is still our nation's first and best defense against efforts to disenfranchise voters.
Well, I don't know whether there's any point in beating up on poor Mr. Varelli, but it seems like all of these cases that we've had recently, where there's been a lot at stake, a lot of people have been disappointed in him. The Chief Justice sort of treated him like a schoolchild, didn't he? When he asked him for examples, and he didn't know them. He didn't know which had the most African American participation, which state, and which had the least.
Well, I think that the reason he didn't know them is because it honestly doesn't matter.
Sure. Well, it was a bit of a red herring. You're right.
Yeah. And I thought Solicitor General Verrilli did a fantastic job. You know, he was actually the one who was standing up at the podium when Justice Scalia went off on his rant and, you know, very calmly, you know, responded, well, there's a lot to say to that, Justice Scalia, which is an understatement. But, you know, what he was pointing out, and he repeatedly emphasized this, and this gets to Chief Justice Roberts' question, is that the Constitution expressly grants Congress the power to decide which voting rights laws are going to be most effective in enforcing the constitutional guarantee of the right to vote free from racial discrimination. So maybe Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Anthony Kennedy would, if they were in Congress, come up with a different coverage formula or different preclearance provision. But the constitutional point that the Supreme Court should be limiting itself to is whether or not Congress showed that there was enough of a record that this was a reasonable, appropriate way to deal with what I think everyone would admit is a continuing problem. And it's not the Supreme Court's job to second guess Congress's decision, particularly given this massive record that they amass showing that racial discrimination continues to be a particular problem in those areas covered by preclearance, which are primarily in the South. And, you know, Shelby County, Alabama, which is the county that's bringing this challenge in the Supreme Court, is a perfect example. They continue to have problems with discriminatory voting practices. And that was brought up today repeatedly by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg.
And Justice Kagan brought up the point that 98 senators voted in favor of renewing the legislation, none voted against it, and yet Justice Anthony Scalia dismissed that.
Yes, you know, I really don't get that, you know, but if he wants to start criticizing unanimous Senate approvals, I would point out that his nomination for the Supreme Court was approved unanimously in the Senate. So, you know, I don't think he's one to throw stones. But more importantly, I just don't get that. You know, I mean, I think it's an example of Congress actually doing the right thing. And, you know,
particularly in contrast to what's happening now with all this gridlock. I mean, whenever the Senate agrees on anything, it's pretty amazing nowadays, you know.
Exactly. I mean, this is an iconic civil rights law that was reauthorized in 2006 by wide bipartisan majorities and signed into law by President George W. Bush. You know, that's something that I think all Americans would get behind, and I think that they will be very disappointed if the Supreme Court strikes down this iconic and still vital statute.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who is the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. And we're talking about today's Supreme Court arguments about whether or not to strike down Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And what was that? And of course, if you go by the normal formula, excuse me, of who are the conservatives are and who the swing vote is, Justice Kennedy. If the conservatives are going to overturn this, and certainly it's pretty clear that Scalia is itching to do so, what Justice Kennedy had to say today wasn't encouraging. And he also seemed to suggest that I think it's Section 2 was sufficient. You don't need Section 5. Could you explain what he was getting at?
Yeah, so the way that the Voting Rights Act works is sort of a sword and a shield. What we've been talking about before, the preclearance provision, is really a shield against discriminatory voting practices. It weeds out most of these discriminatory practices just by the fact that state and local governments will have to get them precleared. So knowing that they're going to be checked up upon, they don't actually even try to go through these discriminatory practices in the first place. So there's a strong deterrent effect. And Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is sort of the sword of the act. It's a more affirmative provision that allows individuals who have been discriminated against in voting or the federal government to pursue litigation against the offending entities. The problem is that it's much more difficult to bring this affirmative litigation. It requires, obviously, the practice to already have been enacted. Even if you try to get, you know, something, even if you try to get the court to stop it from going into effect, you know, you don't have the same deterrent effect necessarily that you have from the preclearance provision. And again, you know, I thought that Justice Kennedy asked some interesting questions about, you know, well, how could that work? And, you know, but it's not the court's job to try to figure that out. Their job is not to try to come up with a better Voting Rights Act. Their job is to consider whether what Congress did is appropriate. That's what the Constitution says, appropriate legislation, whether Congress passed appropriate legislation to enforce the 15th Amendment's guarantee of the right to vote free from discrimination. And I think that a lot of the second guessing that was going on in the from the conservative justices this morning really just has no place in this constitutional dispute.
So do you think that they'll roll back a little when in private on this, given that they had an opportunity to strike it down, did they not, in what was it, 2006? 2009, the Texas,
right.
Northwest Austin municipality versus Holder.
Exactly. And, you know, that's sort of what defenders of the Voting Rights Act like me, you know, hold on to, is that, you know, the conservative justices had the opportunity to strike the act down in that case. And none of them, except for Justice Thomas, was willing to go all the way there. And so, you know, I hope, being an optimistic person, that some of the conservative justices will again think twice before striking down this, what has proven to be sort of the engine of progress in voting equality over, you know, the past several decades. But it's it is certainly very troubling, and you know, the court has dodged the issue once. Are they going to do it again? I don't know.
Well, if they do, though, wouldn't it constitute a classic definition of a judicial activism? Because it would be a vote essentially based upon ideology and this idea that that the efforts to undo discrimination are worse than discrimination itself. That has been going on here forever, and it's because it's affected the University of California and its entrance. And these people make these arguments, and there's no evidence at all. And then when they get their way and they undo these laws like they did with the University of California entrance system, now we have an enormous you know, minority of African Americans and Latinos in the UC system. The numbers have gone down precipitously. So the evidence is clear in retrospect, but You know, this is not based on data. It's based upon a kind of peculiar kind of atavistic kind of ideology.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if you look at the data, certainly I think that there's support for Congress's decision that, well, yes, there are some problems with voting suppression across the country, and Section 2 of the Act, which we talked about, covers the entire country. The concentration of voting discrimination in the South is such that it's appropriate to put this, you know, stronger medicine of the preclearance provision for those covered jurisdictions only. And when you talk about judicial activism, you know, there are parts of the Constitution where the courts are supposed to be sort of vigorous defenders of these provisions. But when it comes to the 15th Amendment's right to vote free from racial discrimination, the drafters of that amendment specifically intended to give Congress and not the courts responsibility for protecting against voting discrimination. And, you know, when you think about the fact that the 15th Amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War, it's unsurprising that they would be reluctant to give the courts power over this, given that just a few years earlier, the Supreme Court had issued the infamous Dred Scott ruling, which said that an African-American didn't have any rights that white men had to respect. So, you know, the framers of the 15th Amendment specifically wanted the Supreme Court to defer to Congress. And so this judicial restraint that Chief Justice Roberts has in particular professed to follow is written into the Constitution when it comes to protecting the right to vote.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Wydra, the representative for Shelby County that's bringing this suit, Bert Rein, he was pretty much slapped down by Justice Sotomayor, who pointed out, because he said, oh, it's all over, you know, we're different now, the past is the past, etc., and we've moved on. She said that in the period we're talking about, there were 240 discriminating voting laws that were blocked by Section 5 objections in your county, for God's sake. I mean, did that shut him up or at least pull him over?
Well, no, unfortunately. You know, that was how the argument opened this morning. Justices Sotomayor in particular, but also Kagan, they really did an excellent job of pointing out that, you know, look, you, Shelby County, are a perfect example of why we still need the Voting Rights Act, because your county has engaged in some of, you know, some very blatant voting discrimination. And so, you know, I thought that Sotomayor in particular made a very strong case for the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. And in fact, she, at the end of the argument this morning, you know, was the one who really pushed back against Justice Scalia's racial entitlement theory of the Voting Rights Act in a way that was very simple but eloquent, pointing out that, you know, the problem that the Voting Rights Act seeks to remedy is discrimination in voting. And that is something that is a constitutional right and an American value, and not some sort of ridiculous, you know, goodie given out to a certain constituency.
Well, it sure is clear to me who are the justices that represent the future and who are the justices that represent the past. And let's hope the future prevails. I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and an action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. And she was in the Supreme Court today since she had filed an amicus brief in the Shelby versus Holder case in defense of Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about America's most wanted gangster. Here comes the